We got multiple officers that are protecting the body from the bear so we can safely remove the body of the victim and return him to his family.
One man is dead, another injured after a bear mauling near Eagle River. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Sitka fishermen don't want the governor to sign a treaty that cuts their salmon allocation.
We're willing to make the sacrifices written into the treaty, but we're not willing to just arbitrarily have our share reduced.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Anchorage police say a brown bear attacked two men, killing one who had last been seen on Monday and injuring another today who was part of a group searching for the missing man. Police spokesman MJ Tim says searchers found the body of 44-year-old Michael Soltis on a trail today near the end of Highland Road in Eagle River.
We got multiple officers that are protecting the body from the bear so we can safely remove the body of the victim and return him to his family.
A neighbor of Soltis wrote in a Facebook post that he was due to be married and had a child on the way. Soltis was last seen Monday night. His vehicle was found at his house near Mile 8 on Highland Road, and friends and family assumed Soltis was out for a hike. Soltis was an avid hiker and regularly went out alone from his home. Soltis was reporting missing Tuesday, and police and volunteers searched the area through the night and into this morning using information from Soltis's cell phone. An Alaska State Trooper helicopter joined the search today. Then police say the same brown bear attacked another man this morning who was part of the group searching for Soltis. That victim, who was not publicly identified, was rushed to a hospital with serious injuries to his leg but was expected to survive. Tim, the police spokesperson, says the bear likely attacked the second time because the searchers had gotten close to Soltis's body.
The brown bear was protecting the body for themselves, but right now the brown bear is on the loose, and so we have set up a perimeter of multiple officers with rifles protecting the body from the bear.
That was midday today. Tim says it's unclear if the bear will be killed as a result of the attacks, but says the officers are ready to defend themselves, given the bear's apparently aggressive behavior. The attacks prompted a warning from Anchorage police to stay away from the end of Highland Road. President Trump signed an order today to address the family separations at the southern border, but it raises new questions. Trump's order calls for families to be detained together.
So we're keeping families together, and this will solve that problem. At the same time, we are keeping a very powerful border, and it continues to be a zero tolerance. We have zero tolerance for people that enter our country illegally.
He ordered the attorney general to try to modify a legal settlement limiting the detention of immigrant children so that the government can hold families indefinitely while their criminal or immigration cases are pending. Senator Lisa Murkowski is the most critical member of Alaska's congressional delegation on this issue, and she's wary of keeping children locked up for long periods, even with their parents. She says the family separations have to end.
But keeping families in detention for an unlimited period of time, I don't believe that that is the answer either.
Murkowski made her comments this afternoon before she'd seen the president's executive order. She says the solution has to consider the needs of families seeking asylum.
Let's go through the process, the procedure that will determine whether or not this is a family that should be able to seek asylum and safety here in this country and allow them that process.
Murkowski says families whose asylum claims are accepted by the government should be released from detention while they wait for their court dates. She adds that the flight risk is lower for asylum seekers who've cleared that first procedural hurdle because they stand to gain legal status. Senator Dan Sullivan did not respond by deadline to questions about the Trump executive order, but he, like Trump, has said it's important to end what they call catch and release, where families and asylum seekers are released from custody to wait for their court dates. Congressman Don Young hasn't taken a position on either of the two immigration proposals the House is set to consider this week. A spokesperson says he's waiting for the final text. Young, in a written statement, says he applauds the president's executive order. Sitka salmon fishermen are worried about the state's strategy for renegotiating the Pacific Salmon Treaty. That's the document between the United States and Canada that allocates the king salmon harvest across borders and expires at the end of the year. As KCAW's Emily Kwong reports, the fleet took to the seas yesterday to send Governor Bill Walker a strong message not to sign what they consider a bad treaty.
Governor Bill Walker's agenda in Sitka was pretty straightforward. Meet with the mayor, speak at a conference, hold a campaign rally. He expected all that. What he wasn't expecting was this.
Let us fish! Let us fish!
Woo! 24 fishing vessels are parading along Sitka Sound on a blazingly sunny day. They're blaring boat horns and shooting off fireworks. Perched on the bow, one troller has an orange traffic cone against his mouth, a makeshift megaphone.
Governor Walker, we need you! Stand up!
He's saying, Governor Walker, we need you. Stand up. Salmon fishermen are worried the governor will agree to a Pacific salmon treaty that deepens cuts to Alaska's king salmon fishery. Standing with a group of conservationists and fishermen to greet the governor, Eric Jordan said, it's a tough time for trollers.
We're willing to make the sacrifices written into the treaty. But we're not willing to just arbitrarily have our share reduced.
Alaska's negotiation team does not consider a reduction arbitrary. ADF&G Deputy Commissioner Charlie Swanton told trollers and processors at a Chinook symposium in Sitka last month that the proposed cuts were carefully negotiated with Canada as part of a strategy to protect endangered stocks in Washington State's Puget Sound and to avert a potential federal takeover of the fishery under the Endangered Species Act. But while Sitka trollers are on board with taking their share of cuts to protect fish runs in this region, they're tired of taking the fall for problems elsewhere. The Sitka Conservation Society's Heather Bauscher said the state needs to prioritize Alaskan interests.
You know, where are the positives? What are the things that are being done to support this region?
After arriving by car, Walker took in the whole scene.
Hi, nice to meet you again.
He waved to the vessels, listening to the words being shouted from the decks. He stood in the street and talked with the group assembled. He told them, we're going to try to get the best deal that's available.
I'm known for doing bold things, and so I'm not a very good follower of this is the way we've done it in the past necessarily.
Walker did not elaborate on what that meant. Walker said he's keeping an open mind on the Pacific Salmon Treaty as negotiations are still ongoing.
Well, I have nothing to sign at this point, and what I like to do before I make any decision on anything is I like to hear from all different sides of it. I celebrate that.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly considers new ways to address homeless encampments.
People are more frustrated than ever because they don't see anything being done. The camps are not done away with.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
State forestry firefighters are working to contain a fast-growing wildfire near Healy that was ignited by two smoldering fires burning in coal deposits at the surface that merged together. Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the fire was spotted yesterday when it had burned only about 5 acres.
And then last night, the winds picked up in, down in that neck of the woods, and the fire got very active and grew to what they were saying, like 600 to 1,000 acres at around 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Mowry says the Lewis Creek Coal Seam 2018 fire is now estimated at 1,800 acres. He says it's burning in an area east of the Nenana River that had been already burned over several years ago. At that time, crews brought in bulldozers that cut a fire line, or in this case, a dozer line around the area. But he says vegetation has regrown, providing fuel for the wildfire.
That dozer line is somewhat overgrown, so what we're doing today is we're getting some dozers down there on the scene, and we're going to rework that dozer line to make sure that that fire stays east of that dozer line.
Mowry says forestry brought in personnel and equipment last night when winds whipped up the fire. He says more is now on the way today.
We've got one crew on site, the UAF Type 2 crew, and then Type 2 Initial Attack crew, the Gannett Glacier crew, coming up from Palmer to tie in with them. And then we also have multiple aircraft, two water scooping aircraft and a helicopter equipped with a bucket that will be dropping water along that dozer line.
Mowry says there's no estimate yet on how much of the fire is contained and when it will be contained. He says there aren't any homes or other developed property near the fire, so he says forestry plans to keep the fire contained and let it burn out. Mowry says coal seam fires are fairly common in that area where the Usabelli coal mine operates. He says the fires present a hazard to firefighters because they could be killed if they fall into a burning or smoldering coal seam. And he says the smoke can be hazardous. Melting permafrost is creating a muddy mess in Alaska's Arctic after two competing broadband projects dug trenches alongside the Dalton Highway for their separate fiber optic cables. The telecommunications competitors leading those projects, GCI Liberty and Quintillion, are now embroiled in a legal dispute over who is to blame. At the same time, state officials are still trying to sort out the scope of a problem that could threaten the only haul road to the oil fields at Prudhoe Bay, as well as dozens of streams along the way. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports.
Between semi-trucks and tourist buses, the two-lane gravel highway to the North Slope can see a couple hundred vehicles a day. The Dalton runs through forested, mountainous, and tundra-covered terrain, and a lot of it sits atop permafrost, which is fine as long as that permafrost stays, shall we say, permanently frosty. But in a bunch of spots right next to the highway, it's not, and state officials say that's because of the trench digging. Because if you remove the topsoil and vegetation that insulates the icy soil in summer, there's a good chance it's going to melt.
We work really hard to make sure that the frozen ground underneath those embankments stays frozen.
That's State Transportation Commissioner Mark Lucan. His is one of three departments to permit subsidiaries or subcontractors of Quintillion and GCI to dig trenches in its right-of-way. Lucan says the trench-related melting could threaten the highway.
You know, that is the primary supply route for that pretty significant industry out there.
He means, of course, the oil industry. But another industry has staked its claim in the Arctic. That's right, the broadband rush is on. And that's where prospectors like GCI and Quintillion come in. They want to tap into a market that's thirsty for cheaper and more reliable internet and phone service by connecting those fiber optic cables alongside the Dalton Highway to some of Alaska's farthest flung communities. But that has meant disturbing miles and miles of permafrost insulating vegetation to dig the trenches to lay the fiber optic cables. Both projects' permits cover 240 miles of digging and require remediation of the ground, as well as preventing erosion and runoff of muddy water. But there are still at least 20 swampy problem areas parallel to the highway that range from 20 feet to 500 feet long. One inspection report even notes the fiber optic cable itself was exposed in at least one spot. Here's permafrost expert Dr. Vladimir Romanovsky with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute.
It's kind of a trench with sometimes even standing water in it, sometimes even moving water. Yeah, it's just strange and unattractive, I would say. And we were joking that soon we may start to use instead of trucks, we can just use boats, you know, just like in Venice, you know, just go along the Dalton Highway in the boat.
Romanofsky says the companies digging the trenches for GCI and Quintillion apparently didn't know any better, which he says is unfortunate, because oil producers on the North Slope have been working on and around permafrost for decades, and the cost of dealing with impacts to the environment and to infrastructure from turning solid, frozen ground into soupy muck should be well understood by now. Romanofsky says he doubts the restoration efforts will fix the problem anytime soon. That work so far has included simply piling more gravel on top of the trenches as they subside. But Romanofsky says gravel conducts heat better than the original vegetation, so he expects the melting to continue.
It all depends how much ice is in permafrost. And unfortunately, in some locations, there's lots of ice.
Romanofsky says it'll probably take years of repeatedly piling gravel on top of those spots to prevent the melting from spreading even further.
It may be 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years.
Quintillion finished its trench before the GCI subsidiary Bortec, and they aren't waiting to point fingers. The company has sued and says Bortec caused the melting and erosion problems. The lawsuit even alleges the GCI subsidiary and another subcontractor removed soil covering Quintillion's trench and put it on top of their own trench. GCI says Bortec, its subsidiary, had no knowledge of that and says the trenching subcontractor, Utility Technologies Incorporated, denies the allegation. But the question of who to blame is still an open one as far as the state is concerned. The Department of Environmental Conservation has issued notices of violation to both sides after inspections saw continued problems with trench-related melting even after restoration efforts last summer. The notice of violation doesn't rise to the level of civil or criminal action. Mike Solter, Compliance and Enforcement Program Manager at the DEC's Division of Water, says they're looking at next steps. Solter says it's not just the highway that's at risk. As the name implies, his department is concerned with environmental impacts to water, and Solter says there are dozens, if not hundreds, of streams and creeks that could be polluted with runoff from the trenches.
It kills fish, it can smother eggs, it can do a whole bunch of really bad stuff. There's really a lot that could be at stake here, and until we really get the chance to assess it, we won't really know what the full impacts are.
That assessment by DEC, DOT, and others was planned for this month. But Solter says based on pictures of the trenches that he's seen from this summer, it's unlikely the situation has improved at all. He says it could still be a while before the full extent of impacts to the highway or habitat are known. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Anchorage's problem with homeless encampments in public parks and trails is reaching a new crisis point. That's according to a collection of increasingly organized and vocal community groups petitioning the city to get more aggressive in dealing with the problem. The tension was on full display at an assembly meeting today, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
It was standing room only midday at City Hall as advocates, municipal employees, and elected officials crowded into a conference room. Over the last year, meetings of the Assembly's Homelessness and Public Safety Committees have taken on a sense of urgency, with members of the public growing increasingly impatient with the city's management of the sprawling, unlawful encampments that speckle Anchorage's parks, trails, and green spaces. Neighborhood groups and community councils have become more organized and involved in the issue, criticizing officials for a lack of transparent communication, and even presenting assembly members with a 12-point list of recommended actions. Assemblymember Dick Traney has been on the assembly off and on since the early 90s and says he and his constituents are seeing the issue of homeless encampments on public lands getting worse and worse.
People are more frustrated than ever because they don't see anything being done. The camps are not done away with.
The administration of Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has taken big steps to create new housing and support services to get people off the streets, but it's a long-term strategy that many say has inadequate solutions or stopgap measures for addressing overflowing shelters, a concentration of struggling individuals on the east side of downtown, and messy, sometimes dangerous encampments throughout the Greenbelt that area residents say make them feel unsafe in their own homes. The city has a system for cleaning up vacated campsites, but it lacks the resources to keep pace with the problem. Parks and Recreation Director John Rada told the assembly that since January, crews have cleared 65 tons of material from unlawful encampments, double what they'd collected by this time last year. Right now, the Assembly is reevaluating its strategy for clearing campsites. It includes a proposal to expedite removal when camps are close to a newly created class of protected public areas. Those include popular trails, playgrounds, schools, and recreation areas. The move's intended to classify broad zones where encampments cannot take root. The proposal could spark a legal challenge from civil rights groups. Traney says that the threat of litigation shouldn't stop the Assembly from taking more assertive actions.
My constituents are calling me up demanding action being taken. And they're right, we are the ones elected to do this.
In addition to the Assembly's revised abatement ordinance, the administration is set to unveil new components of its strategic action plan on homelessness in July. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
The Environmental Protection Agency's decision to roll back a regulation to make hard rock mining companies pay for cleanup is sparking a new legal battle between Alaska and environmental groups. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports from Bethel.
Alaska is intervening in a lawsuit over the Environmental Protection Agency's decision to rescind a rule that would make sure hard rock mining companies pay for cleaning up their mess, even if they go bankrupt. Hard rock mining refers to any kind of mining that deals with metals like gold and copper. For instance, the proposed Donlin gold mine in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and the proposed Pebble mine in Bristol Bay. Then-President Obama issued the rule under a law targeting industries that release hazardous waste and Superfund sites. Corey Mills, a spokesperson for the Attorney General's office, says the state already has a program in place to make sure mining companies are held financially responsible. So Alaska doesn't need the EPA's help. But Earth Justice attorney Jan Hasselman says the proposed rule would not have usurped the state's program.
I think the key finding that the EPA previously made was that there were gaps in the state system and that there was a need for the federal government to come in and set a uniform floor for these kinds of activities going forward.
The Trump administration rolled back the rule in December of last year. Now the new EPA position is that there are already regulations in place from states and federal agencies that require financial assurances for cleanup. So environmental groups, including Earth Justice, petitioned a federal court to review the agency's decision. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
The University of Alaska is moving forward with a controversial Haines area timber sale. Amid concerns, the university's Board of Regents delayed advancing the sale at its last regular meeting. But as KHNS's Abby Collins reports, with more information in front of them this week, regents were nearly unanimous in their decision to approve a development and disposal plan.
At a special meeting this week, Regents voted 9-1 to approve a development and disposal plan for the sale of timber on 13,400 acres of its land in the Chilkat Valley. The vote authorizes the university to move forward with contract negotiations for the 10-year negotiated sale, announced in March, estimated to generate 150 million board feet. Regents heard from UA President Jim Johnson.
In the case of our land development, we can not only look at our regulations, we can look at our history. We can look at actual cases of how we have done land management sustainably and timber harvest sustainably and responsibly.
The university has about 150,000 total acres in land grants, which fall into different categories.
It's frankly, again, not much land and certainly not much of large commercial value. And so what little of that we have, we seek to monetize.
Johnson said UA wants to diversify its revenues by increasing those coming in from timber. The Haines project is estimated to bring in $10 million. He said revenue from land development funds things like the Alaska Scholars Program, University of Alaska Press, and Cooperative Extension. After hearing from Johnson, Regent Andy Tubert was the only one to vote against the approval.
I'm not particularly fond of the approach that we're taking on this for the return that's deemed to be forthcoming over the course of time.
Others, like Regent Dale Anderson, spoke in favor of moving forward.
Our fiduciary responsibility as board members is to the University of Alaska and the well-being of that school, of that university.
The university estimates the sale would create 55 to 60 new local jobs in its 10-year span. Regent Karen Perdue, who lived in Southeast for many years, voted in favor of the approval, but said success will come in finding a balance.
So my interest is sort of balanced between understanding that these communities need jobs. We as regents have a fiduciary responsibility, but we also are abutting up against a pretty significant treasure, which is that reserve, and also that Haines has extensively worked to promote a tourism economy.
A portion of the land included in the timber sale falls within the bounds of the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. However, this harvest would be permitted because university lands are excluded from restrictions imposed on the preserve. Johnson said the university is working to address concerns about eagle habitat to minimize or eliminate impact. According to his presentation, the timber harvest area could end up being much smaller, depending on environmental requirements. In the Chilkat Valley, the proposed sale has drawn excitement from residents who see a big economic opportunity for locals. Still, others fear it could alter the land in a way that has real consequences for the environment, including fisheries and other wildlife. The Haines Assembly continues to have disagreements on the sale. At a meeting Tuesday, some assembly members and the borough manager expressed concerns that the interactions with and positions of the local government were misrepresented to the regents. Based on feedback from the public and regents, the university has developed a set of guiding principles for moving forward. It also plans to work with a local advisory group. Once negotiations are completed, the contract will go back to the Board of Regents for approval. That's expected to happen later this summer. The university is working with the Division of Forestry and Mental Health Land Trust on the project. A multi-agency review will be conducted through the permitting process, and there will be future opportunities for public comment. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Kwong in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Abby Collins in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.